Hello, I'm stand-up comedian James Mullinger, and the co-founder of Edit Magazine. This is Mullinger Meets Canadians, the podcast where we meet Canadians who are making waves on the world stage. In this week's episode, I'll be speaking to one of the most renowned singer-songwriters in Canadian musical history. I am, of course, talking about the one and only Joel Plaskett. From rocking Halifax's marquee club to performing for the masses around the world and sharing the bill with other Canadian power bands including Sloan and the Tragically Hip, over almost three decades, Joel Plaskett has forged a reputation as one of Canada's most engaging and beloved performers. He's won multiple awards including Juno's, Canadian Folk Music Awards, East Coast Music Awards. He's just the best. I love Joel, and I'm walking into his studio in Dartmouth right now to meet him for the first time, and I can't bloody wait.
Hi, Joel.
James.
Great to see you.
You too.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nice to have you here. Welcome. Oh, yeah, we'll elbow knock from a distance. And, yeah.
Virtual hugs,
yes,
all around.
Yes, exactly.
Lovely. Yeah. Wow, this is incredible space.
Thanks. Yeah, yeah, it's tidy for you today.
Oh, that's very kind of you.
Yeah, we set up so we could have a chat.
That's nice.
Yeah, yeah, but no, it's a nice big room.
Sure. Wow, this is literally where the magic happens.
Magic and failed experiments as well. This was an old storage facility for fur coats.
Wow.
So it's a big space. It was like a refrigerated locker back in the day to store fur coats. So we've turned it into a music room.
That's nice.
Yeah.
And it's nice. Keeps it cool on a warm day.
Yes, it does. And it's pretty insulated from the outside world. Occasionally you can hear like a car horn go off and add some character to a record.
And then you just, do another take. Happy days.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's your place. You're not having to pay by the hour.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Yours.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I ask, starting at the beginning, what you remember about growing up in Nova Scotia?
Oh, okay. My brain is full of memories. That's all it is most of the time. I grew up in Lunenburg, Nova Scotia. From the age of 4 till I was 12, and then we moved to Halifax, to the suburbs, to Clayton Park. So I have really, really vivid memories of Lunenburg. Previous to that, we were in like the valley. I was born in Berwick, Mahone Bay, and this and that. But I don't have really clear memories. You know that weird place where you're not sure if it's a memory or it's just a photograph that you looked at. It's more photographs at that point. But Lunenburg, I have these really. I kind of know that town like the back of my hand. And when I think of it, one of my favorite things about it, my dad's a big heritage buff, and I've got a deep appreciation for old buildings and stuff that I've sort of inherited from him. Lunenburg, because it's a World UNESCO site, now is sort of frozen in time in terms of the houses and what you can do there on a development level, which... it's kind of great because I can walk down the street and I'm like, hasn't changed here one bit? It's a very, there's different, the town's not as busy with fishing and things like that. Right. But it is neat that visually, there's a lot of really still remaining visual reminders where a lot of my memories in Halifax have actually kind of, the physical spaces are gone.
Right.
You know? So anyway, I don't know if that answered your question.
I guess it was obviously a very happy upbringing and you've inherited that kind of love of place from your dad. How do you think that kind of has inspired you throughout life, that kind of love of place and of specifically this place?
Well, I mean, I've felt really fortunate here. I've had opportunities. So that's part of it. And my childhood in Lunenburg was like very relatively like free and easy. It was that kind of town where you'd just walk to school by yourself at 5, you know, you just walk across town, we'd go off into the woods or what have you. And I would just go bicycling by myself at 10 years old to Mahone Bay, which I would, now kids don't move as sort of, there's more cars and I guess sort of more perceived danger as to whether there is or not, I don't know. Yeah. But I don't know, I guess I feel very at home here just because I don't really know any different. Right. But I also have traveled so much that I've experienced other places, which has given me an attachment to this place. I think if I felt trapped here, I might engage it differently. But I've always felt like I've had opportunities to explore. And that's not to say somebody who stays here their whole life doesn't love it too. I just mean I've been able to get my love of traveling through my work.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
which has allowed this place to remain sort of a refuge.
Yeah, a magical kind of place to come back
to. And then a familiar sort of place and a place that's sort of, I don't know, you know, and you get to know a lot of people.
Yeah.
Which is
you know everyone. Hey?
Well, I don't know about that, but I feel like when I'm walking down the street, rarely do I not recognize someone.
Right.
And so that familiarity is by and large a good thing every once in a while, you know.
What about when you were starting out in the music industry? And obviously, you know, your father Bill was a musician, and I'm guessing that's what kind of inspired you to follow that path. But did you ever feel there was any disadvantages to being on the East Coast of Canada when you were starting out and trying to break through?
When I started out, I was in a band called Thrusher. Mm. We started playing when we were 15, 16 years old, and we started gigging downtown with other bands. You know, at 16, 17, we were opening for Sloan. They were getting going. We were in the right place at the right time, the scene.
Yeah.
And so we signed a publishing deal, and then we signed a record deal, and we toured America. And, and we left, you know, when we left high school, we made sort of a pact to not go to university for the first year so we could go and make noise and try and take advantage of these opportunities that were in front of us. And so we kind of hit the ground running, had some success. You know, it wasn't massive success, but it was enough to keep us interested. And certainly over the 7 years that we spent touring, for me from the age of 18 to 25, I sort of went, well, this is what I now know how to do.
Right.
I love music.
Yeah.
I like performing. Mm-hmm. I like the connection that it allows me to feel with other people that I don't know.
Right.
I think that's maybe what has kind of kept me in the game was, there's always a certain amount of ego you bring to the stage sometimes, or certainly that's been the case, you know. but ultimately, like, and so I do like to perform. I like to entertain, right?
Yeah.
As I know you do too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But I also love the feeling that when you're playing music, or when you're performing or what have you, when people get together to congregate, to and they don't know each other and they have a shared experience, and if you know, I'm sharing that experience with them, and it makes me feel connected to people that I don't know, and in a way that makes you not feel so alone, I suppose, because the world has this sort of way of, if you can feel quite isolated.
Yeah,
I still really value congregation. I think that's what's hard about this COVID era right now for musicians and entertainers and stuff, is there's that sort of desire to go out and connect.
You know? Yeah, for sure. And on that, I mean, that, this period, of course, as you say, is difficult for people, you know, creatively, financially, all of those reasons. What do you think it is that audiences and performers miss most about that kind of shared experience that they're...
I mean, I think it's... If anything, I can't help but feel like it's the random's the wrong word. It's the fact that you don't know what you might go out knowing what to expect, but every time you go out and you involve yourself with other people in a physical space, usually there's something that goes, well, I wasn't expecting that, or that was really cool and that happened. And now you have this like memory in time and space that kind of leaves a mark on your memory. And it's not to say that can't happen on Zoom, but I don't think it's as readily, I don't think it's as evocative.
Right.
I don't, you can still make a connection, have a great conversation with somebody, or people play shows on Zoom, and I'm sure there's some degree of connection that goes on there. Mm-hmm. But you know, there's something about like, going like, yeah, you remember the smell in the air when we rolled into Sudbury or whatever, and you know, the meal we had at that, you know, you have your whole, you have this sequential thing that happens that lays itself out your day, and that involves other people too, and sometimes people that you weren't expecting to run into, and then there's the people who show up at the show.
Yeah.
So like these markers add up to something like really, like a deeper weave that makes you feel human. connected, I suppose.
Yeah.
And it's like the interconnectedness, and it's that thing that I think this downtime, or strange time, whatever you want to call it, is a reminder of. It's also a good time to sort of like step back from that and like try and make ourselves more resilient on our own as well. Because I think you can get dependent on that stimulation too. I certainly felt that way for the first bit of this pandemic. I was like, I didn't know who I was.
Yeah.
When the stage was taken away from the kind of my monthly routine where I'm always gearing up to go somewhere and do something. And I had a record that just dropped and we were about to tour it and all of a sudden gear it down and I'm just sort of like staring at a wall, sort of having to ask myself,
like, who am I?
Yeah, it was weird.
Was that must have been very hard that you've been working on what many have said is your magnum opus, and you've come up with this. I mean, it's colossal.
It's long, and it's
incredible. Yeah. And I think as David Miles said to you, it's like, what's amazing? It's some people might be able to come up with 44 tracks, but you came up with 44 amazing tracks. Oh, it's just brilliant throughout to work on something for that long. And then to come out with it, and then suddenly the world shuts down. Was there any moment when you thought about holding back the release, or how did that go? And what was your mindset like?
Well, we thought about delaying the release. First of all, we discussed that, and it was sort of like, okay, let's delay it. Okay, let's not. Oh, okay, let's delay it. Okay, let's not. It was about four like conversations over the course of like a week, because I sort of saw this thing coming. You know, like you could see the world shutting down.
Yeah.
And so we decided to release it regardless. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't change that because the record's so long to engage it requires time.
That's true.
And it met people at a moment where they were at home probably, you know, and so the people that did engage it had more time and space in their life to engage.
To listen to it as it was intended.
So there was a strange, like irony is the wrong word, but synchronicity, I suppose. And I would say that, you know, funnily, what I was thinking about, and I'm still thinking about, but leading up to that record, and part of what I was trying to document was a number of years, and also this sort of acceleration of time that I felt in my 40s.
Right.
And with the world, and like kind of a desire to slow things down, while at the same time, like, I'm a really verbose person. Mm. So the 44 songs is like this kind of like, you know, trying to like, I'm throwing stuff into the spin, and I felt like I'm kind of caught in the spin, so I have things to say or to write about or whatever. But there's a desire there to kind of like to reflect and to actually get into long form. Yeah. You know, that was part of the desire with the record, was to have a long form exploration of my, of a sort of imaginative place, you know, some stuff autobiographical, other things that were sort of like just sort of imaginative or something. And so I wanted to do something that was kind of, but when the pause happened, with COVID, it was frustrating because we were about to go out and sort of tour it, which would, in some ways is kind of when you start to feel, there's the release of the album, but when you perform the album, that's when the release comes for me. Like when I perform the record is when I'm kind of letting go of the songs. They're no longer just recordings. They become, you're not just dealing with one performance, which is your recording.
Yeah.
Your recording is the performance by which somebody goes, oh, that's a good or a bad song, or that's a good performance or bad. Mm-hmm. But when you go and you play it every night, it's now alive in its own way, and it exists outside of the record, and you're kind of released from the record.
Wow.
You know, in some ways, from the fixed point in time.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that I think is challenging about the world is that we're often trying to fix things in time and space, right? And so we go, this is what you said. And it's like, well, yeah, that was the way I felt that day or whatever, you know? So you're always changing. And it's not to say that you don't try and, you know, go, you know, this represents me or what have you. But the idea that things evolve, I think, is important.
Yeah.
And that maybe a song can change. It can change from the meaning from when it was written, changes once it's in the listener's hands, and it changes for me as I'm singing it. So that kind of got eliminated. Or not eliminated, but stalled that release.
Well, does it feel then it's in a kind of a purgatory moment when it can't quite...
Exactly. Yeah, it was like purgatory a little bit. But Then after about a month of really, or maybe more like 2 months of kind of feeling sorry for myself, and that still comes and goes, was sort of the recognition that maybe I do place some stock in things that things happen for a reason, you just don't know what they are. And of course you sort of can make the reason. If you can look at things from the other side of the coin, then all of a sudden you take a situation that was in one way frustrating and you flip it and go, well, what's the positive side of this? So the pandemic's done that to so many people. It's caused that sort of, I'm not, you know, everyone's using the word pivot, if I have to say it again, like just, like make me pay $10 if I say it again. I sort of viewed it as the record found an audience in a different way because of the pandemic. And I will always associate that record now with this time.
At what point did you know that 44 was going to be what it was?
There was sort of a point, maybe a year before it was done. Maybe a year or 8-10 months before I kind of finished it. Mm. I'd had a bunch of tunes. I'm always sort of recording. If I get an idea, I often will want to document it. Wow. Relatively quickly, or demo it, you know. And because the luxury of having a space is being able to sometimes, I mean, this is a commercial studio, so it gets rented by other people as well. But when there's time available, I'll come in and I'll often like work on something. So I had a bunch of different kinds of tunes. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know what kind of record it would make. I didn't know if it would be a band album, a solo record, something with some different people. I was just sort of, any one time I tried to look at the songs as a single record, I felt like it didn't interest me. And I couldn't figure out how the songs were going to sit beside each other. Uh-huh. And then there were some covers that I was thinking about. And it sort of grew to maybe like, there was maybe 20, 25 things kind of kicking around. And then I was thinking about, like my record 3 was one of my more, was certainly my most successful record.
Yeah.
And a fun one to make because it had this, I've always like with every record, I try and put a parameter around it. Yeah. And depending on the frame, then that informs the way I go about doing it. Yeah. And 3 being a triple record was like 3 9s. I love numbers, right? I'm pretty into numerology. And it's a sort of a, kind of, it's not really obsessive compulsive, but I love balance, right? I love symmetry. And so that to me was, so I was thinking about, I said, 3 was there in the back of my mind. And then I realized, okay, like I was talking with Sherry, my manager, and we were trying to plan when this record of whatever I was making was going to come out. It's like, all right, well, let's release it. During a pandemic, but I realized it was going to come out I was making much of the record and it was going to come out while I was 44.
Right.
And I'd been writing these songs, I'd been thinking about my 40s and these kinds of things in the songs or what have you, these. And I realized, okay, 44, and like I was like, the balance of that, the 11s. Yeah. Of the 33 11s, and I was like, it's 11 years since I made 3. I could sort of suddenly see this sort of like window to the past and to the present. Yeah. And I went, oh, that's kind of like, man, is that too much? And then I looked at the songs. I thought I would do it. Well, I don't have 44 songs, but I got a bunch. I got 20 or 25. If these were going to be on different records, where would they sit? Or what would it look like? So I took a few songs and I went, these ones make sense. This is, and then I started to take a few songs and imagine a mock sequence. I do this, it's all in steps. So I'd start to sequence what I had. And that's not to say that's even the sequence that's on the record now. It's always a moving kind of thing, but you start to kind of go, okay, I could start, that's an opening volley, or this could work. Mm-hmm. So you start to see what the painting could be. And then I realized, well, if I want to tell something long form, if I want it to feel like a journey, and I want it to be a journey for myself. I don't really know where this is going to end. I decided I wanted to go to Memphis to do some work because I'd recorded there in the 90s with Thrush Hermit.
Right.
And there's a few musicians down there that I really have a lot of admiration for. I wanted to work with them, and I went to Nashville and did some stuff on that same trip. Recorded a couple songs in Toronto, and then most of it here. We mixed it all here.
Yeah.
All these kind of like threads coming together, and And so you start to kind of zoom in, and then songs start showing up. Yeah. And often the way, this is sort of the way I work with Three, so and with other records too, I get the frame,
yeah.
and I go, well, what's missing, or what does it need? And then, or I don't even necessarily intellectually think that all the time, that becomes apparent.
Right.
And often the writing just sort of sends me to what feels like needs to change. Mm-hmm. And then you start to see connections lyrically. And then sometimes the last little bit of it is when you're going, I don't have a second verse for that tune. And then I go, well, what have I been writing? Well, like, and then you go, then you can start sort of stealing a word or two or a phrase, and you can start recycling. Wow. And then the weave gets a little deeper, and all of a sudden, so a lot of lyrics show up across it. And so I like that. I've always, where I kind of got an aberration from that from was growing up loving Chuck Berry's sort of songs, the language that he used and the way that he kind of evoked these similar things all the time and would almost refer to his own songs. And then Bruce Springsteen, I think probably taking a page from Chuck, did the same sort of thing. So I that idea of a world, right? Of creating kind of a world. And so that's kind of how, there's the long spiel of how 44 kind of turned into what it was. And then it became very, very deeply linked to the artwork.
Right, which is beautiful as well.
Which I was really excited about. Mm. And still for me is like is really kind of close to my heart in terms of the way it was put together. Because it's sort of a shelf that we created. It's out in the lobby.
It's
good. And it's sort of not in full flight right now, but it has memories of people. There's songs for people, friends that I'd lost on the record and this and that. And so there's these kind of, it's like a memory shelf to kind of take me, it's like a portal for me to kind of recall people and places and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that became part of the art. And then what was really interesting was there's this moment really late on the record where I was still recording the last few songs. We'd already shot a bunch of the artwork and we did the final bit of the art. And all of a sudden the last few songs were informed by the art. Not like, so it worked, it kind of looped around on itself.
Yeah.
And so to me that was one of the things I've never really experienced where, because normally art is the last thing you do. You've done your record, it's mastered. All right, let's figure out the art. But this was like, the home stretch of this was happening at the same time. And so there was a lyric on one of the last song, on the last song on the record, like twin moons and missing friends reflecting in the lens. Mm. And there was this thing that happened when we took the shot of the cover, which is this shelf backlit through a window on a field on a cliff in Cape Breton. And I did this light painting of the word 44 using, and it was a long exposure with a flashlight. It was a film on a film camera. And the lens caused the 44 to flip and invert in blue. You can see this reflection show up in reverse. So 44 upside down in the bottom of the image because of the way the light reflected off the lens and created this magic in the photograph.
Amazing.
I always thought that was super cool. And so that kind of got written into this lyric. And so I think of these kind of, so there's all these weird little things that most people wouldn't pick up on, but I sort of am reminded of if I kind of look at it the way it was put together.
Yeah. That's incredible, but with all of those moving parts and all of those different elements, how do you know and how did you know when it was done?
Well, there was a deadline. I will say that, like, I go through moments of feeling feeling balanced, but I don't necessarily hold on to it for very long. Usually when I'm doing things, whether that's making a record would be probably the more, I feel like that's when I'm kind of often most out of balance, but really driven to create because it takes a certain, I hesitate to use the word selfishness, but it does unfortunately impact your life. If you're hyper-focused on something, you can't bring that, you can't always bring yourself back to the dinner table in a really successful way.
Yeah.
It kind of takes over my life in some ways when I'm on the home stretch of something or if I'm really deep in it. And then the road has its own imbalance too, because you go out and you're kind of used to this sequential order that you have to your life. You have this form to your day that's really satisfying.
Yeah.
And then you get home and that form is changed.
Yeah,
and nobody applauds when you do the dishes, you know? Nor should they. Yeah. You know? So it can push you to and fro, you know.
Yeah.
Yet I love the process of making records. I mean, I like producing things for other people. Yeah. The same thing. I love that focus on the finish line. What's this about? Why are we doing this?
Right.
It gets deeper. It gets more meaningful. It's still just something to do,
yeah.
But it's important. When it's happening, if it feels important, then it kind of is.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the memory of doing it, and it's the idea that you're going to have something to show or to do, even if it's just for yourself, there's something I think really important for me at least. I don't know, it's a self-expression thing, but it's the idea of trying to communicate to and maybe express something that I don't even know what it is. And then if you sort of somehow abstractly do that, somebody finds something in there, and now you have something in common, even if you're interpreting something different.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's sort of, I don't know how I got to there from your question. And I don't even know if I answered your question.
You did. It made sense. You must get lots of fans coming to you with their own interpretations of what they take from the music. How often do they get it right? And what does it mean to you to kind of hear those insights that are so personal?
Well, I mean, I get sometimes people tell, you know, it's usually a song that maybe somebody would say, you know, this was our, I mean, people, like there's a few songs that have become people's wedding songs, and
yeah.
That's deeply meaningful, you know? Mm. It's really, really cool. I don't always know what to. It's always nice hearing stuff,
mm-hmm.
It's funny though how sometimes I think I'm being either very clear or kind of explicitly saying, yeah, it's this, and somebody goes, I thought it was that, and it's like, oh wow, okay, and then you realize like interpretation is everything.
Yeah.
I saw this like YouTube video that somebody pointed out to me. I showed it to my son today. It's these like six or eight balls in a circle. They're making a circle and they're going around bouncing on the screen like this. And it looks like they're rotating, but they're actually all the balls themselves are just traveling on straight lines.
Oh, interesting.
If you could look it
yeah,
up, it's
yeah.
a way of showing perspective where
yeah.
you think this whole thing is rotating, but the balls themselves are not, that make up the circle aren't. They're just traveling on straight lines
yeah.
back and forth. And so to me, it's like it's an example of perspective.
Yeah.
And you think you're spinning in a circle and somebody goes, no, you're just moving sideways, you know? And
that's the perfect metaphor for exactly that.
And
yeah.
so, and it's weird because when you take that into the world now, it can kind of really unseat the way you feel about things for at least temporarily,
yeah.
which isn't a bad thing. Like, I feel like it's always, it can be strange to think, oh, I've been really misinterpreted or somebody took this. And, you know, I mean, it's like people take song, you know, I mean, Bruce Springsteen had Born in the USA kind of co-opted by Ronald Reagan at the time in some fashion,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
and he didn't write it that way.
Yeah.
You can't really, once you put something out into the world, it's going to be something different to everybody. That's not to say you want your message co-opted,
yeah.
But you can't fully control it.
Yeah.
And so there's sort of a lesson in, I guess, just, you know, there's always a risk involved, but by and large, what I find really cool is that people, when a song resonates, when you can see it happening live, it's really remarkable.
Yeah.
Where when you can feel a certain song really crest with an audience,
yeah.
And that can be with a lot of people or with just a few.
Yeah.
And actually sometimes it can be really heightened. For me more and more, it's like I try and tune into the audience, but you also occasionally kind of go into your own head. I'm sure you
yeah.
like right when you're
yeah.
performing, right?
Yeah.
You sort of,
you go into this kind of different, it's like a higher state almost.
Yeah. yeah. And you feel like, it can be really, it's invigorating. It's an adrenaline rush.
Yeah.
It can be really emotional sometimes. And a bit, it can unseat you a bit, but it can also help you reach a higher, like a different point of view
yeah.
on what you're doing. And you realize, oh, right, when I was writing this, I thought I was just doing that. Mm. Now it's doing this, you know?
In March 2006, when Nowhere With You really kind of exploded, how did that feel? And did it kind of, did it feel different to the previous success you'd had?
At the time, it was. I didn't register it in, I mean, it did feel different, I suppose, but it was still quite gradual. And I mean, and I appreciate using the word exploded.
Oh, well,
but true. I mean, it didn't, you know, it wasn't an international hit. Well, it was in a Zellers ad that was really, really, or that was very popular. And as a result, radio stations, I think what happened was the radio guy at my label was like, hey, you know that song in the Zellers ad? Can you add that to the station? Oh yeah, it sort of was already out there
right. In
a very successful ad campaign.
A Zellers ad in Canada is Canada's Super Bowl.
It was a big deal. It was Canada's Super Bowl at the time. So it put it in front of a bunch of people.
Yeah.
There was a lot of groundwork that sort of led to being able to run with that.
Yeah.
It was neat to have a song that suddenly sort of was on radio stations that had never ever played me. So like, because it went into sort of like the middle of the dial, like office, in the office,
right.
Radio station, you know?
Yeah.
And so that was neat because all of a sudden that song kind of registered with people who maybe had no idea who I was. But mm-hmm. we had, you know, when Thrush Hermit broke up in 1999, mm-hmm. I had already made a solo record called In Need of Medical Attention mm-hmm. and had started doing some gigs with a 5-piece version of The Emergency. My drummer, Dave Marsh, who still plays with me, and is one of my like oldest collaborators mm-hmm. and friends, he was part of that band. Anyway, when the Hermit called it quits at the end of 99, Dave and I and Timmy Brennan, I had some new songs. I wanted to sort of make a rock record, which became Down at the Khyber. Tim Brennan came back to town, joined on bass. We made a 3-piece band and started recording stuff down on Barrington Street at the Khyber building, which is vacant right now. But yeah. And so we made a record called Down at the Khyber there and started touring. And I had an audience, a small audience from the Hermit days
right.
already there. So we could go to Toronto and play to 150, 200 people.
Yeah.
And I had an opportunity to get some good opening slots. Mm-hmm. So we did that. Then we did Truthfully, which was another Emergency record. And then I went and made a record called La Di Da, which was a solo record in Arizona. But one of the things that happened on the tail end of Truthfully around the time of La Di Da, I can't remember exactly, but we got an invite to open for the Tragically Hip mm-hmm. on Canada Day in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And we had a good show and we
yeah.
did well. I think we did well in front of the Hips audience who we had heard could be sort of notoriously fickle in their desire just to see the Hip and no one else.
Right.
And we had a good gig. And so a number of months later, we got the call and said, do you want the national tour with the Hip?
Right.
So we toured nationally opening for the Hip in mm-hmm. hockey arenas, the Metro Center here mm-hmm. or the Scotiabank Center now, you know? And so that put us in front of a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so when Nowhere With You got in the Zellers ad, this sort of work had been done.
Right.
And we could pack clubs across Canada in,
yeah.
some, in varying levels of packed.
You know,
or of size. I
suppose. You were ready.
We were ready. We were a club band, but mm. we had played an arena now, and
yeah.
we had played with basically one of the biggest touring bands.
Mm.
And I have to give like a huge shout out to the Hip and in memory of Gord too, who was like
yeah.
watched our show from side stage most nights when we were playing.
Wow,
and, was really really a great champion for Canadian music and, mm. and helped us so much. So Nowhere With You hit. And mm-hmm. and kind of hit radio. And so we could kind of just capitalize on that, for lack of a better word. And then that EP that we did that Nowhere With You was on was produced by Gordy Johnson, who was in Big Sugar. And so Gordy produced 3 songs for us, and then he did our next record, Ashtray Rock.
Oh.
And I learned a lot working with Gordy. He's really good engineer and producer. And I, as sort of an aspiring producer myself at that time, mm. was working with like 2 Hours Traffic, who were a band from Prince Edward Island yeah. at the time. you know, a lot of the things that I sort of learned from watching that Gordy was saying to me, I kind of saw, oh, there's some wisdom there, and those became some production tricks I could take nice. Into my own work, and I developed my own little bag of tricks that I could, yeah. and so, you know, you kind of learn about arrangements yeah. and what's effective, and one thing that Gordy has a real sense of, because Big Sugar were, they were playing big shows, right. you know, was the kinds of things you do in production that reach the back of the room. Like, I'm a big fan of, like, idiosyncrasy and little detailed nuance and stuff, and maybe a joke that nobody gets. Gordy was like, get that out of the way and hit the tom-tom right here. Don't have anything in the way. And in the back of the room, a beer's going to get cracked or whatever. You know what I mean? It was like he had a way of, like, going, this is how you push this idea right to the back.
Yeah.
Smart. And it kind of, in a very kind of classic rock or stand up straight and tall sort yeah. of. And that doesn't come totally naturally to me because I'm a bit of a slouch, you know? But it was a good lesson, and I've sort of taken that and tried to apply it to things now and then.
Right.
And, sort of 2010 and 11, and that's sort of when really, that's like on the three tour, we played Massey Hall. That right. was sort of, and that's still the, and then we did it on the Solidarity tour as well. And so that was the biggest venue really in terms of like prestige and, or it's the wrong word, just sort of reputation, I guess. It's a fairly, yeah. you know, it's an iconic venue. Yeah. To be able to play that as a headliner was really, it was meaningful, you know, because yeah. it just meant like, okay, this is like connected with enough people.
Did it feel like a kind of we've made it? Was it that point or?
Yeah, I don't know. I've always felt like I'm trying more to enjoy things in the moment, and I do enjoy the moment of being on stage.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, you don't really know what you're doing when you're in it.
Right.
I still don't. I'm trying more and more to like, detach myself a little bit, but then of course, like if you detach yourself, then you run the risk of like not enjoying it too, right? So it's a weird thing. But it's this idea that it's like when something's really joyful, you're like, when something's painful, you're like, this will pass. But there's also, you have to remember when something's really joyful, it's like, this too shall pass,
yeah.
you know? And so you kind of have that, you balance between those. And in a desire to, maybe be more balanced sometimes, but also recognizing that your ability to get out of, if you can hold yourself
yeah.
in an awkward place or in a, if you can teeter a little bit, you can also do really, you do things that you wouldn't have done when you were in balance, right?
Yeah, it's true.
So if you, because you have to recover or you have to figure out how to like, well, if these are the cards I'm playing right now, then yeah. like, let's make it as interesting as you can.
Yeah.
So I just kind of, I like that. I like that teeter totter, but more yeah. and more as I get older and as I'm kind of trying to like slow the pendulum mm. a bit and not, still work hard, but not get really wrapped up in any one moment and thinking that's like a definitive thing.
And is that why you had so many collaborators on 44? And again, collaborations with people that you haven't worked with for a few years, bringing them
yeah.
back. Was that all part of that kind of thought process?
Yeah, not consciously at first and then maybe consciously when
right.
I realized like, okay, like that song I have to play with Dave Marsh, who plays drums with me, because Dave has a way that he plays, and it's a thing that he brings. But the challenge is navigating your friendships and allegiances to people, and my band included, who have been really, I mean, I don't want to even say my band, because it's our band when we're
right.
playing together, you know? That's really important to me. It's valuable that I've been able to play music with the same two people for so many years.
Yes.
But I also have this desire to, like, get surprised by other people or to sometimes follow my nose on my own because I sometimes feel like getting hung up on decision-making or democracy
yeah.
In a studio. It's hard to get to the finish line.
Yeah.
So I'll sometimes take it upon myself just to try and like kind of not solicit opinions
yeah.
until I kind of want to hear them. And that's maybe yeah. a bit, there's something a little, maybe selfish about that, but it's kind of, I feel like I got to put some structure around stuff to, or else I won't get stuff done because I'm somebody who will I take stuff, like, I'll take stuff to heart.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just going to slow down the whole process.
Yeah, it slows it down. And then when you're doing something like 44 songs, it does become a sort of, there is a sort of kind of a point where you want to see a check mark on a piece of Bristol board, like, that is done. That's done, you know? Yeah,
definitely. That's beautiful.
Yes.
So what's your favorite song to perform live on stage?
Hard to answer, changes nightly to some degree. Yeah. There's ones I don't get tired of playing. Mm-hmm. Through and Through and Through is a really fun one because it has this back and forth vocal that we recorded with Rose and Anna there on the record. Great. And so when you said, you know, good things come to those who wait, and you can see the audience like singing it. And, that to me is like a really joyful one. And then there's introspective ones, or not introspective is the wrong word, but just maybe softer or more nuanced ones that aren't as rock and roll. There's a song called Captains of Industry from Park Avenue Sobriety Test that I've always liked playing because of the melody and the words, and it always feels right. There's something about performing, and I don't know if you can, if you feel this way, but, and this is what's strange about the Zoom era that we're in, or this pandemic era.
Yeah.
The few things I've done in a live stream situation is like, you feel like you have to act because there's no audience there.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I'm more of an actor when I'm by myself in a room where I feel like I have to act. Maybe that's just a self-imposed thing. Live, you're acting too, you're performing, it's performative. So what I like about songs is they allow me to go into a different headspace, and the music, it kind of feels like your soundtrack changes, even if you're singing it. And so certain songs lend themselves to like going into your own headspace as opposed to going out watching everybody and letting them do the work.
Yeah.
There's these other ones that flip it, you go in, and then that performance becomes sort of like, you feel like you're acting in some ways, but you're allowing the song to set the stage.
Right.
And all of a sudden and when you got a lighting tech is really good on your side.
Right.
You know, and you go, wow, you know, and you can see the audience suddenly feel like, and you see them respond to that very idea in their own way. That's really cool. Yeah. There's sort of a feeling of like a magic trick happening.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of like live music. Yeah. That's the thing that I think you'd be hard pressed to get in the digital universe.
Agreed.
Because there is something about a collective of people where when the hair stand up on your arm.
Yeah.
It's like if the hair stands up on the person five rows that way on their arm, it might be happening. You know, there's something called, there's like a collective unconscious going on in the space. I really do believe in that transference. Yeah. Like, I don't think it's hocus pocus. It's a real thing. I think it's a hard thing to articulate, and you can't necessarily put science to it. You can't apply a scientific lens to it, but certainly an emotional one. To me, that's like the beauty. So that's in songs, any given song, if it allows you to do that, that's my favorite one that night. The song that you can choose that makes the, and you don't know what it's going to be until you're doing it.
Yeah,
that's what's weird. You think, oh, this one's going to do what it did last night. I didn't do it tonight. And it's a different song that did that thing that you thought it was going to
do. Yeah, it's the exact same with jokes.
Yeah, it's totally same, right. Yeah, there's so many parallels. You think you're going to knock it out of the park right here.
Yeah, you think you like that, you're going to love this, and you're like, why is this energy not? Yeah. And then something else that just comes out of nowhere and boom.
Yeah, and you make something up.
Yeah.
And this is one thing I'll just like swing it back to my band for a second, or our band. Yeah. Dave and Chris are really great at winging it.
Right.
And we don't rehearse that much. In fact, months and months and months will go by. And then when we have something, it's like, well, we better grind off the rust. But ultimately, that's just us getting together and winging it a little bit so that we can get up on stage and do a version of that. That improvisation where you kind of can feel like that the audience feels like, oh, this is sort of happening. We don't know what it's going to be.
Yeah.
I think that's something I really cling to. And that's why we don't play with in-ear monitors or play to track.
Yeah.
And I'm not begrudging anyone who does that. There's other ways to create a magic spell.
Yeah.
but our version of performance has something to do with, yeah, okay, the song goes this way, but we really don't know what's going to happen at that. If, you know, like, I use a lot of body language when I'm playing. I play guitar with my feet, is sort of the way I think of it. Like, if I move my feet a certain way, I'll bend the string a certain way. And I can see Dave sometimes at the kit watching me, and then I can, if I start gesturing something, he starts gesturing it. Like, you can see him go, and it works both ways. He starts doing something, and I can feel that, and that push and pull, and then Chris is kind of on bass. His job in the middle is off to sort of, like, kind of hold us while Dave and I kind of go like this, you know?
Wow, that's incredible.
And to me, that is, like, a really, that is one of our strong suits, I think, I hope. I feel that, at least... And so that to me is like what I'm desperately sort of missing. Yeah. But I'll take this downtime to do other things. But I'm looking forward to that like shimmy, that weird, awkward thing that that turns into something great. You know.
Yeah. It's beautiful. And what are you listening to right now?
I've been. Let me think here. I've been enjoying and really impressed by the Fiona Apple record, Fetch the Bolt Cutters. That really, heard a couple tracks. I heard a song on the radio on CKDU and was like, who's this? Oh, and so I bought that record and it was really, really remarkable production and energy to it. It's really unique. I tend to go back to older music. There's been a lot of Marty Robbins playing in our house.
Nice, you know? Nice. That's a good call.
Ghost Riders in the Sky. My son likes Marty Robbins. You know, it's funny. So we've heard a lot of Marty Robbins. I figured a big iron on guitar, and we were singing that the other day. There's a band from Memphis, no longer a band, but that part of the reason I went to Memphis was to work with a guy. With this guy, Doug Easley, who had recorded this band, The Grifters, who also had sort of a spinoff called Those Bastard Souls. And the main writer in Those Bastard Souls is a guy named David Shouse, and he was involved in on 44.
Okay.
He doesn't really play guitar or keys much anymore. He makes music using lights. He has this, and so he triggers sound using sensors, and as you close the light on a sensor, the pitch goes up or down and it runs through effects pedals. It's one of the wildest things I've ever seen.
Crazy.
It's really neat. But he had this great band called Those Bastard Souls that was a big influence on me. And so I mention them because I think they made a record called Debt and Departure, which is like one of my Desert Island discs, and I just keep going back to it. And more recently, when I was in Memphis, and Dave was helping me on this recording, he said, I'll play you some stuff you might have not heard. And so we went out to his minivan and he played those Bastard Souls outtakes. They were these songs I'd never heard and they were so great. And then I just noticed they showed up on Apple Music. So I was like, okay, cool. So I can listen to this stuff that I'd been introduced to. So I've been going back to that.
Nice. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Mullinger Meets Canadians. If you like greatness, creativity, being inspired, laughing, or just love Canada as much as I do, then this is the podcast for you. So please do subscribe and review the show now. And be sure to follow Joel on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Joel Plaskett. And go to joelplaskett.com to download his albums, or better still, order them on vinyl. Further details can be found on the Edit website, maritimeedit.com. I will see you next time. Podstarter.